gratitude. But I never knew at the moment love was just an interlude. I'd thrill as your arms would enfold me. A kiss of surrender set the mood. Then heaven fell down when you told me love's a passing interlude. The magic was unsurpassed, too good to last. The magic.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Monday edition. Today's date is the 8th, I believe. Yes, it is. July 8th, 2008. And my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me again for another important broadcast of the French Connection. More information coming your way. Going to out the bad guys again, as usual, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to put the names out there for you to do your own research from. Many of the subjects that that I touch on with my guest today are starting points or seed points for you to do a lot more investigating. If you take a look at some of the threads we pull in these discussions with my guest Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, they lead to all kinds of new information, and you, in many instances, you'll be able to bring up these people's activities all the way up to the present day with who took over their places and what they're doing, because these threads, these things, they actually build into the modern day. And what we've been able to do on the French Connection, unique than other sites, is to show you how this thing has worked from the beginning of their conspiracy till now. And as we go back in history here, as we've gone backwards in this chronology here, we're back right now on 1821. And now that seems like a whole heck of a long, long time ago, but fact is, it's an unbroken line to the present, which is what we've proven by doing these installments every week, is that if you read or listen to these broadcasts, you'll understand that these people's crimes have never ceased. And in fact, they have gotten more aggressive and more pervasive and more destructive to each and every one of us, to the point right now, ladies and gentlemen, where we are on the verge of losing our freedom permanently and violently, possibly, at the hands of these criminals. So I have to really take my hat off to my guest, Andrew, because he and I have been doing this we just discussed before I pressed the record button on this, for 3 years plus, and from way back when we were just shipping emails back and forth about the criminal group of Rothschild & Co., till now. And I couldn't be happier to have this guest on with me again. Andrew, are you with me?
Yes, I am, Daryl. Thank you for inviting me on the program again.
Well, it's great to have you back. As usual, we're gonna do the best we can at getting this information out. Now, one of the things that's been happening lately, and I guess we've touched another nerve with these people somehow, there are forces out there working overtime trying to destroy destroy the messenger. Nothing to do with our information. They're just going after the messenger again, as they have from time to time for both of us. But I've kind of probably caught a lot more of that than you have. But they're out in full force against me on the internet right now, and I've been banned in a couple of more servers in Europe here. I'm wondering if you're getting the same kinds of attacks lately.
Well, yes. Your former partner, Eric Hafschmidt, he claimed that I was Jewish in a broadcast, which was incorrect. He never sort of asked me or anything, came to me to sort of say, look, I've heard this information or I think this information or whatever. He just decided to say it. So I just politely emailed him back and said that he was misinformed. He's since emailed me to ask for a further explanation, which I've got into, and then he's written a long article about me on his site about, well, it doesn't matter if I'm not Jewish, I don't have to be Jewish to be bad. Well, that's a fair comment. I've got no problem with that. He then goes into the fact that Alfred Hitchcock was probably Jewish, and there's pictures of him, and he looks Jewish, and then it just goes on and on and on. It's just absolutely pathetic ravings of a madman. And incidentally, for the benefit of the audience, and I shouldn't have to go into this sort of level, I asked people to look at my work, and if people honestly think, as he says at the end of his article, that I don't attack Israel, and I do talk about another topic that we don't discuss on this show for reasons that the listeners are aware of.
Yeah.
If they don't think that, they've clearly not read the book, and he hasn't. What he's being mistaken on is that he's only ever read the Rothschild timeline, which is, as it was, the Rothschild timeline. The book is about three times more information, and the reason I put it into a book was I was getting all this other information, and it was just too big, really, to put up on a site, which is why we've, you know, given the listeners the ability to get it in bite-sized chunks. We've split the book up into 10
yep.
segments. We've worked backwards. We're on segment 9 today.
Yep.
And it's meant each time that that's gone up every few weeks that the listener can read an easily digestible segment rather than being faced with the whole lot at once on a screen, which people don't tend to look at.
Well, you know,
it's just too much.
Well, this same guy, I mean, I have come to understand that his goal has been to destroy cohesion within my support base as well as many others, and he was using me as a jumping off vehicle to destroy other people's reputations. And when I got done with this horrendous criminal, I of course felt a lighter load around my world, but at the same time, it actually got me involved in doing more historical work and bringing together historic past with present. And in fact, it was thanks to Mr. Hubschmidt. Thank you there for moving me in the direction of beating these guys over the head with history. And so they can thank Eric for getting me involved in tying history to the present. And if they want anybody to be upset with, they can go and see him because he did it to them. And thank you very much. But that being said, by the way, you know, they're claiming I'm Jewish now also. Apparently I look Jewish in a photograph or something. They said I look like Joe Pesci, and apparently Joe Pesci's Jewish, so I must be Jewish because I look like Joe Pesci.
Well, I've met you and you don't look like Joe Pesci. I didn't know Joe Pesci was Jewish. But the fact of the matter is if people honestly think that you and I are Jewish, then they'll believe absolutely anything. The work that we put out attacks the areas of criminality within this group, and it's not restricted to Rothschild, it's not restricted to Israel. We talk about things that a lot of people have never even heard of.
That's right.
Because it's not out there, and we're the people putting it out there. What I have discovered, I've had emails from supporters who basically said, other people who've been in this movement, that this is a regular tactic that they've used over time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's there's really nothing changed in their modus operandi. I'd never actually been attacked directly by Eric Hubschmidt, and as you know, in private conversations I always said, well, I believe that it was a falling out that you and him had, and you were kind of, and this kind of all came about with an email I sent him some months ago after I'd heard him attacking you again, and I actually sent it to both of you saying I think you should just both move on and do your own work and not worry about attacking each other. I was wrong. I thought it was just a fight like that going on and you were chipping away at each other, but it's clear now to me that he's had absolutely no reason to try and do what he's done to me and what have you, and he just has. So, you know, I can only say to the listeners, make your own judgment, but make sure you use the facts and listen to the sort of things that he's putting out and what he's writing and compare them to what we're putting out and what we're doing.
Well, you know, one of the things that's happening, though, there are some agents working for whomever knows that are out on the blogs and forums, and even some of the you know, the other websites stating that the facts that I put out that I can prove, that I have proven in the past, are being ignored, and then they're bringing up old chestnuts to try to destroy my reputation. So that's not uncommon for me to face, except that it seems like it's really being charged up anew here, which is fine with me. I it just gonna in the end, what I've discovered is that when people do their due diligence, they look behind the veil, they end up finding out that that the stuff that these people are putting out are lies, and it just gives me more credibility. That's been my experience, at least, anyway. You know, it doesn't really matter, Andrew. All I know is that if you read the books and you take a look at these different documents we've found over this 3.5 year period, you can't deny the bad guys are from a certain community. But when people claim that I'm Jewish, and I certainly am not, but I don't really care if I were or not. It matters not. Somebody actually had the audacity to say, why do I put Jewish researchers on my site? And, you know, I've explained this before. First of all, I'm not against Jews. I'm against criminals. And I have no problem with Jewish people who are not part of this crime gang, because and we've said this before together, you and I. I mean, if you found out that the Italian Sicilian mafia was robbing your business every day, you wouldn't blame every Italian person for what these Sicilian mafioso are doing. You would say, well, yes, they are Italian, but not all Italians are robbing me. It's the same concept. I mean, and a lot of the Jewish community out there aren't even aware of what their leadership has been doing. But the upshot of this is, I believe, and I have believed for a long time, that the best way for these people to be destroyed in their base is to have their own community reject them. And, of course, Ben Friedman and Fagan and Bernstein and there's several others out there that have actually come out with some good work. David Cole, and somebody asked me why I put David Cole's work up there. Well, I don't know whether David Cole is an honest man or not. I don't know anything about it. All I'm putting up in my site was that David Cole is a Jewish gentleman who made certain discoveries. His information speaks for David Cole. I don't speak for David Cole. I don't verify the veracity of his assertions. What I am saying is that there are Jews in the world who seem to be fighting against the crime gang. And I believe that as a group, they have the most effect, and they hurt the criminals the most, because they undermine their support closest to home. Now, I don't know if you agree with that.
Yes, and I think that you know, it's important that the research, as long as the research that's going up there, and if, you know, without the Ben Friedman speech, you know, how it's things like this that have pushed it more and more forward. And the interesting thing is, with the attacks that were made on you, they increased a great deal from when you split up with Eric, and so it goes to show that at that time you were putting these historical books up, which are very, very difficult to get hold of, some of them, and when you do find them, they can be quite expensive, so yep. A lot of people can't afford to get the information. The way that we're doing it here, for example, something like the Henry Ford book, I remember I had that on order from the only place I could seem to get hold of it when I was trying to get it was Amazon.com, and that was on order there for months, and they kept writing to me saying, oh, it's been delayed, but sort of trying to show they offered it, but they didn't seem to, certainly when I was trying to get it. And so, you know, a lot of these things are out of print, and they're out of print for a reason. We put them back into print by getting them, or rather you have, by getting them up on the site. And ever since you've been doing that, you've been absolutely hammered.
Yeah.
And then I came back and I decided to put my book up for free on the site.
And now you're going
to get exactly. And so it just goes to show that people just need to... I mean, I'm at a stage now where I really couldn't care anymore. We've got a couple more installments to do with this, and I've enjoyed doing these and getting the information out. But, you know, I've got my own life to lead, and if all you're going to get is just, you know, being attacked for stuff that you've tried to do, and people can't make up their own mind for the information you've put together, you know, I... That that's kind of it for me as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'm a normal guy. I got into a subject that I got quite interested in. I was always fascinated with this, you know, what started out as New World Order and stuff like that. And originally I kind of set out thinking I'd be doing a website and have a bit about Bohemian Grove and the Council on Foreign Relations and all this, and nobody was more shocked than me when I found out that it was all linked to by this group.
Yeah.
And that's why it turned into what it turned into. The original Rothschild timeline was the first subject I decided to tackle. After, at the same time, I was doing Bilderberg lists and things like that, and I was going to put all that together that people could get just on the ordinary website. And as I did that, and you know, you keep listening up another rock and saying, oh, not you again, and they just keep popping up. And so the whole thing linked together, which is kind of how the book wrote itself by accident in a way.
Yeah.
But it's amazing, you know, this is the information. If people have problems with information, please email me the information they have problems with. But I would appreciate it first if they do their own checking, because there's no point asking me to verify something that they have got a problem believing that I've said. If I had a problem with that, you'd get a second opinion. So what they need to do is they need to start off with an internet search engine or something, do a bit of research themselves to flesh a topic out. And if they still don't have any luck, then my email address is on the site and they can contact me.
Well, let's get going here. You're going to be doing an interview with the most attacked man on the internet, me.
Yeah.
Let's go here. 1821. It's Klansman Karl Meyer Rothschild is sent to Naples, Italy. Let's talk about what he was sent there to do, because this is where you know, this gets into the Catholic Church, ladies and gentlemen, and you're going to be shocked. But when we discuss this is the time frame that the Catholic Church went up in flames. Go ahead.
Well, what we've got here is we've got, of course, you had all the Rothschild brothers, and we'll go more into that next time as to how they were sent to different areas of Europe to, you know, do their infiltration and what have you. And Christian Kalman, but he's commonly known as Karl Meyer Rothschild, was sent to Naples, Italy, and he went on to do a lot of business with the Vatican and Pope Gregory the 16th at the time conferred upon him the Order of St. George. Now, it would be only a couple of years later when the Rothschilds would take over the financial operations of the Catholic Church. So when people say, oh, it's all the Vatican Bank, well, again, who controls the Vatican Bank? What we've got here is we've even got a situation where whenever the Pope receives Kalman Meyer Rothschild, he gives him his hand rather than the customary toe to kiss.
They actually used to make them kiss their toe?
Yeah.
Yeah, like that I would do, like, please, give me a break.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it still goes on, to be honest. And so what we've got here is this, going back that far, we're talking about nearly 200 years now, 185 years, that they've getting control of the Catholic Church, and
yeah,
you can imagine all the finances involved there.
Well, now we get into the Emperor of Austria. Now, this is at the heyday of the Habsburg Austro-Hungarian Empire, and they confer on the Rothschild family the status of baron throughout. Now, one of them doesn't want to join. Why? Do you know why that is? It doesn't really give me an insight into that.
No, it was, this was Nathan, who was the actually the brightest of the Rothschilds, or regarded as that. He was the one who actually had already taken over the Bank of England.
That's the one that helped do the Waterloo rip-off, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was the one over in England, and I think that he felt that, you see, at that time as well, you've still got all these, you know, infighting in Europe, and there could be a variety of reasons for it. He may have wished not to take the title due to he didn't want to take something from Italy when he was in the UK. In England. Of course, you know, we have a Church of England over here. And that all came about in rebellion to the Catholic Church. So the things could be linked there.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you've got Austria as well.
We 1823. They talk again about Rothschild. Very active this decade. When they get involved with the Catholic Church again, but this time something quite a bit more important, huh?
Well, yes. As I say, this is this is the year they took over the financial operations of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And you know, that level of power is something that really moves them forward. But it's all down to money again.
Yeah. Well. Sir Walter Scott, who was this gentleman, and what was the importance of his book on Napoleon?
Well, he was many things. Obviously, he was quite a noted writer here. And what he said in this book on Napoleon, which was incidentally a 9-volume set, he said that the French Revolution was planned by the Illuminati, and the Illuminati was the organisation set up by Adam Weishaupt for the Rothschilds, and financed by the money changers of Europe, of course, the Rothschild, and that's in the that set.
Yeah. Well, now they had a setback here coming in. We're moving to 1828 with. Probably the greatest American president ever, not Lincoln, not Washington, not any of them, but Andrew Jackson of Tennessee. What did Andrew do, and what is so important about 1828?
Well, I agree with you, Dale, with Andrew Jackson. He we'll be touching on him a bit coming up, but Andrew Jackson was running for president. Andrew Jackson knew about this group getting control of the money and then getting control of the country after they've got the money. And in 1828, there had been 12 years where the Second Bank of the United States, which was a central bank, had manipulated the American economy. American people had just basically had enough, and opponents of the bank knew how good Andrew Jackson was, so they nominated him to run for president. And despite all their shenanigans, Jackson won the presidency. So the Rothschilds tried their best, but Jackson won it, and he made it clear that he was going to use the first opportunity that he had to kill this bank off. And what he did when he started his first term was he got rid of all these people in government that actually were linked to this bank, and to show how deep, even back then, this sort of conspiracy and the amount of people they put into a place just to get what they wanted, he had to fire 2,000 of the 11,000 employees of the federal government. So he fired about 20% to ensure that he could do what he wanted to do, and he wouldn't be undermined by people that were supposed to be working for the government but were actually working for the Rothschilds.
Well, we get into this guy David Sassoon, and now Sassoon is a Jew from Baghdad, but he's also a banker, David Sassoon and Company. And he had branches in the Orient. He was a big Oriental. He had Oriental liaisons across Japan and China and whatnot. What is it that this man did? Because there were other very important historic events that he triggered on behalf of Rothschild, did he not?
Well, yes, David Sassoon was basically linked to the British royal family and the Rothschilds. He controlled the opium trade in China, Japan and Hong Kong, which sparked off the Opium Wars. And what he did, he was trafficking nearly 19,000 chests of opium, and the money was being split between him, the Rothschilds, and the British royal family. And even today, with all these we'll talk, I think we move into the Opium Wars in greater detail a bit later, but even today we know about the so-called CIA drug running and the links to that,
Yeah, well, you know, there's a Jewish family in South America named Kirchner. They're one of the wife now. It was the husband was the head of the government, but now it's the wife, Kirchner. But there are several presidents in South America who are connected to the Murano Jewish groups, and they're involved in cocaine trafficking very, very heavily. And there's a lot of Jewish money in the cocaine trade out of Colombia and Panama and in Mexico as well.
Mm. And you, the drug trade is a very important area for them because it A, makes them money, and it B, causes misery for people, so it destabilizes people so they can use it. Essentially, they're getting all these people hooked on opium makes for a weakened population, and they're far more easier to control.
Yeah.
And they don't, and then you get lots of people hooked on these sort of drugs, and you don't have to worry about killing them off yourself because they'll be doing it amongst themselves because they're so, you know, they lose their self-control.
Well, again, our great heroic president, Andrew Jackson, again, in the 1832 period, killed the bank for a second time. They try to get it through again. Now, what he came up against is what we all face today. It's our Congress and Senate completely bought and paid for, and of course, they tried to ratify above his veto the second bank under Rothschild, and he vetoed it, and they weren't able to defeat his veto. Well, why don't you go into a little bit of that? That's an important point in history again.
Well, yes, they were trying to pass a renewal of the bank's charter 4 years early because they were obviously worried that he was getting more and more control and getting rid of more and more of their minions in government, so they were running out of time and they might not, you know, they could lose their bank and lose their control. But he actually made and Congress sent the bill to him for signing, and this is the statement that he made. He said, "It is not our own citizens only who are to receive the bounty of our government. More than 8 millions of the stock of the bank are held by foreigners. Is there no danger to our liberty and independence in a bank that in its nature has so little to bind it to our country? Controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, and holding thousands of our citizens' independence would be more formidable and dangerous than a military power of the enemy. If government would confine itself to equal protection, and, as heaven does its reins, shower favour alike on the high and the low, the rich and the poor, it would be an unqualified blessing. In the act before me, there seems to be wide and unnecessary departure from these just principles." And so he vetoed it, stood for re-election, and he then took his direct... This was the first sort of re-election campaign that went to the road, you know, actually going... This was on the start of these big... You know, we see all these sort of conventions and what have you today,
yeah,
in the presidential elections. And his campaign slogan was Jackson and No Bank. And the Rothschilds poured over $3 million into the campaign of President Jackson's opponent, which was Republican Senator Henry Clay's. Jackson was re-elected by a landslide in November. And following his victory, he was aware that the battle had only just started, and he said the hydra of corruption is only scotched, not dead.
Ah.
He then went on, I'll jump forward, he started removing the government's deposits from the Rothschild-controlled second banks the United States have been talking about, and he instead put them into banks directed by Democratic bankers. The Rothschilds then panicked, and so they did their usual trick of contracting the money supply to cause a depression. This is a quote that many people will have heard who've looked into this subject. President Jackson knew what they were up to, and he said, "You're a den of thieves, vipers, and I intend to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out."
Well, he is our greatest. He's the only president successful in giving us true liberty, and it was because of his efforts and the seeding of his freedom initiative through getting us out of the banking structure that allowed us to stay free for as long as we were. It was our return to that nightmarish system that killed our liberties for good, and that was, of course, in 1913. But let's go on here. We're talking about the Italian revolutionary leader Giuseppe Manzanini. is selected by the Illuminati to direct their revolutionary program. Now, do you know that he was Jewish? Because, of course, you know, in a name, you cannot see. Only in about half of the instances are you able to connect someone's affiliation to this group through their last name. So you would think a name Manzanini is an Italian name, but what we find out often is that they are actually crypto-Jews in many instances. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely, and the crypto-Jewish thing was going for a very long while. The situation here, we'll discuss the Illuminati with the setup next time, but, you know, Weishaupt is long gone by now, and he appears to be the person who took the succession on.
Yeah.
That role.
Well, let's go on here now to the 1835 period, and they're trying to get rid of Jackson. Of course, Andrew Jackson is enemy number one for the criminal bankers, and they will spare no expense trying to get rid of this man, and they make several attempts, do they not?
They do, and on January the 30th of 1835, and there was an attempted assassination where the assassin shot him with two pistols, but both of them misfired. Jackson went on to claim that he knew the Rothschilds were behind that assassination, and even the assassin, which was a guy called Richard Lontz, who was found not guilty by reason of insanity, he bragged that powerful people in Europe had hired him and promised to protect him if he were caught. And I wonder who those people in Europe were.
Well, we know who they are. It's a group called N.M. Rothschild and Son. So let's go on to 1836 now. We're moving across this period rather quickly, but let's go. Jackson finally succeeds in throwing the Rothschild Central Bank out of America when the bank's charter is not renewed. Now, that's 1836, a great day in American history. Should be a day we celebrate above all others. And so what happens here? We see several things happening in that year. Why don't you take us through that year's chronology, Andrew?
Well, what's basically happened is we discussed earlier that the bank tried to get the charter renewed 4 years early. I think the charter was set up for about 20 years or something like that. And he vetoed that, and of course the charter was actually up for renewal. And he said, no, I'm not renewing it. And so he beat them. And when you bear in mind, we hear a lot about the Federal Reserve. Well, the Federal Reserve was set up in 1913. The Federal Reserve was the next central bank after this one. America managed to keep the central bank out from 1836 right through 1913. And I think America is, as we know, in a terrible state today, but there may not be no today if Jackson hadn't have killed that bank when he did.
That's right.
Because if it had gone on for another renewal, I can't see them, you know, we'd see a very, very different historical picture. And interestingly, when he died, this is how much it meant to him. On his gravestone, he's just got written, "I killed the bank." And that was what he considered was the best way to sum up his life. It was that important to liberty and freedom.
Well, I'd like on my headstone, "I got rid of Zionism."
Yeah, that suit me as well.
Yeah. Let's go on to the 1837. Rothschild sends one of their own, August Belmont. Now, that sounds very British, Mr. Belmont, but it's actually an Ashkenazi. Talk about that.
Right, well, yeah, August Belmont, there's some interesting things that you can look up about him. He's he was sent over there because although a central bank is, you know, it's what they want, it's the overall control, it's keeping all the, you know, plates in the air at once spinning, if you see what I mean. But when they can't get that, they'll get control of other banks, and they'll create other banks and what have you, and so they can get control of finances there.
Yeah.
And that's essentially because in the end they need to kind of start from scratch again, infiltrate what's left, and then work on their push to another central bank again. And then they'll do that by saying, oh, as they did in the Federal Reserve, all these different big banks saying, oh, we really need a central bank, even though they're all controlled by one group.
Yeah.
And so it was just the start of that. It just goes to show that they'll never leave it alone. You know, if these people are allowed in, they will always be a threat, it seems. They don't just walk away and say, oh, we got kicked out of there. They'll just go straight back again until they get what they want.
Well, we know that today, and so this time we have to do it differently, and I'm hoping that people can start thinking outside the box and not use the same methods. We have to make sure that this system does not get reestablished. But 1839, we've got Sassoon again, and the British Crown involved in shenanigans in the East. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, this is where, mentioned earlier, what's happened by now with this Sassoon is the opium addiction in China is just rampant, and the Manchu Emperor of China ordered the trade to be stopped, and he named the Commissioner of Canton, Lin Ti-hu, as leader of a campaign against opium. Now, this commissioner organised the seizing of 2,000 chests of Sassoon opium and ordered it to be thrown into the river. Sassoon informed the Rothschilds of this, and they then demanded that the armed forces of Great Britain retaliate in order to protect their drug running. And of course, what goes and happens, we get what's known as the Opium Wars. Now, what the Opium Wars actually were the British Army fighting as mercenaries to protect this group being able to sell, you know, drugs to the Chinese people. That's what it was about. A lot of people don't look into it. It's that simple.
Well, the British Army, again, we've already been through this, was used as a private army of the Rothschilds to go down into South Africa and steal the mineral wealth and inflict slavery and indentured servitude on the local population of South Africa.
Well, yes, and again, there they call it, you know, they gave that one a name, the Boer War.
That's right.
Boer means farmer. You know, they don't want to say the war against the farmers. It doesn't sound quite as glamorous. So the interesting thing here is that even though the Chinese really did try to fight this off, their society was decimated because the opium addiction was so widespread that they lost the war. That was in 1842, they signed the Treaty of Nanking, and this is the provisions within that treaty. There was going to be full legalization of the opium trade in China. There was going to be compensation to David Sassoon personally of £2 million for the opium that was dumped in the river by the Commissioner of Canton, Lin Ti-hu. Territorial sovereignty for the British Crown over several designated offshore islands.
Which became Hong Kong, right?
Exactly. And, you know, so people don't ask questions about that. And it's just astonishing how, you know, back then, it's mind-blowing how they can do these type of things. And it just goes to show the sort of insanity that is within this group.
Well, again, they show their hand in the bullion business and the gold industry here in 1840. Rothschild does. Let's talk about what he's doing, what kind of nonsense he's doing in 1840 here.
Well, they named themselves the Bank of England bullion brokers because they had control of the Bank of England, and as we know, they were setting the price of gold
all the way up until 4 years ago.
Exactly. They also set up agencies in California and Australia, and of course, you know, we just need to look at the supposed gold in Fort Knox, which, from all that I've been told, is actually empty. So,
well, John Tyler. Now, Tyler is an unknown president, but he too should be vaulted as a hero because he stood up for what was right in the American government and said no to the bank again as they tried to get the thing reestablished after Andrew Jackson was unelected. So, again, it's interesting that the people who have written our history in the United States vault the crooks and don't tell you much about the guys who really fought for freedom.
Yeah, I mean, the presidents like Jackson and Tyler, you don't hear a lot about.
No.
It's, you know, they don't like to teach you the history about any of these guys, because then you might realise what a corrupt system you live under today. And the other interesting point here is, of course, Belmont's only been in America for about 4 years at that point, and he's already managed to, this has already got going, and it was Rothschild agents all around Congress trying to tout this idea of a new bank, and then as soon as he turned it down, he got hundreds of letters threatening him with assassination, and we all know who was writing those.
Well, I know a little bit about what that feels like. Yeah, I do indeed. Solomon Meyer Rothschild purchases the United Coal Mines. Now, that's not all that important in itself, except that it tells you that they're not just concentrating on North America, but they're working worldwide to control industrial production in almost every marketplace there is. This one happened to be where, Andrew?
It was around the sort of Hungarian area. It was Vitkovice and Astro-Hungarian Blast Furnace Company. And the other interesting thing here, of course, is that we're seeing them getting into, as you say, diversifying into all sorts of areas. They want control of everything. This is the key. They don't just want the money system. The money system they need to get control of everything else. But the insanity in this group is that they have to own everything.
Yeah. Well, we got Draselli, a Sephardic Jew, becomes the first British Prime Minister. Now that he's not the last one since. We've had several, some of them crypto, including Mr. Churchill, who was Jacobson. His mother was Jewish, so he's Jewish. So we've had several since. But let's discuss Draselli and what he. Why don't you tell everybody what he said, because this is really telling.
Well, Disraeli, he wrote a book which was supposed to be a fictional book, but it was well known that he characterised Nathan Mayer Rothschild, and what he said about him was, he was the lord and master of the money markets of the world, and of course virtually lord and master of everything else. He literally held the revenues of southern Italy in pawn, and monarchs and ministers of all countries courted his advice and were guided by his suggestions. And this is in 1844 that he's talking about the power that this guy had. He also goes on to say, which was an interesting statement, the racial question is the key to world history. All is race, there is no other truth. Which for you know what, when at this stage we haven't got the term Zionism coined, that was probably because, you know, someone like this who's a powerful Jew will see all Jews as the sort of, you know, the Rothschild is the archetypal one, you see what I mean, and he's going to be proud of that heritage.
Well,
he's trying it in people's faces there.
A sad day in New York City in 1843 with the establishment of B'nai B'rith.
Yeah, the group that goes on to establish the Anti-Defamation League, who finances probably something
isn't that a pip? These guys use anti-defamation in their organizational name when all they're about is defaming.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing what these people, we've talked about the ADL before, and again, it's with all the control, I think there's some case going on at the moment, isn't there, but that keeps being delayed.
Yep.
So, and, you know, don't look for any sort of justice to come out of that, people, because it won't.
Well, we got Andrew Jackson dying in 1845, which he outlasted their assassination attempts and threats, and you already mentioned what is on his headstone. Is there anything else important about the passing of Andrew Jackson and what happened that year?
No, I think I'd just like to, you know, it's good to pay tribute to a true hero.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the book that I've written, it talks about all the bad guys and not a lot of the good guys, and he was one of the real good guys that probably saved a hell of many hundreds of thousands of lives just by an untold misery, by the bravery that he showed when he could have quite easily walked away at any point with a payoff from these people, and not had all the assassination attempts and what have you that he had, but he was guided by his principles and he lived his life as such.
Well, it goes on here to say that the French railroad system was owned and built by them, and it linked up to his brother's ownership of the Austrian railroad in that same year. And we still have SNCF, which is Société Nationale de Chemin de Fer, which means the railroad. And the railroad here in France, of course, is still heavily controlled in the construction side of it, and the actual train cars themselves are built by a Rothschild-held company called Alstom today. So these guys have never lost their control of these businesses. They've just hidden their control.
Yes, that's right, and this is what they do. We have all the setting up of the various front companies and what have you. We talked about, well, with Switzerland being forever neutral in wars, etc. And this is how they hide it. They hide behind different companies, and you never get to see the great network. You get to dip into it. But to actually see all the controls and, you know, public-private partnerships and all these sort of things, it's all controlled by this group.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, 1848, we've got Moses Mordecai Levy. Who is Moses Mordecai Levy for our uninformed listeners?
Well, Moses Mordecai Levy is Karl Marx, which is rather interesting. We talked about crypto Jews earlier. It's funny how people think Karl Marx or German, this sort of thing. Well, of course he would, because he changed his name. Because what he did was, of course, father of communism, published the Communist Manifesto. At the same time as he was doing this, Karl Ritter of Frankfurt University was writing the opposite, which formed the basis of Nietzsche's work.
Yeah.
And Nietzsche's work basically gets developed into fascism and Nazism, and Marx's work gets turned into...